75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they? Welcome to the UFO Fox with your host, Jerry Piven. And now, here's Jerry.
We're here in Laughlin at the Flamingo Hotel, and Robert Dean is with us. And Robert, you're back in Phoenix.
Jerry, I'm back in Phoenix. This is probably where I'll spend the rest of my time, yeah.
Well, you know, Phoenix is pretty famous for, of course, the Phoenix Lights and a few other things. But you're here at the conference, and it's actually been a pretty good conference.
I've enjoyed it, Jerry. I enjoyed it a lot. I came primarily to visit with old friends. I was not a speaker this year, but I wanted just to touch base with a lot of my old friends because I'm slowing down some, and I'm not able to get around like I used to. And once in a great while, meeting with old friends is kind of encouraging and delightful.
When did you first get involved in this whole scene? It's been, the 50s or 60s?
I first got involved, Jerry, back in 1963 when I was assigned to SHAPE headquarters in Paris, France. I went over there on a military assignment. I was a career military person, and I arrived in the summer of 63, was assigned to the Supreme Headquarters Operations Center, was given a cosmic top secret clearance, and while I was there, the following year, 1964, they published a sensitive document that had been under study for at least 3 years. And I was working in the war room. I had the clearance. The document was put into the vault. I had a chance to see it, and so help me, that's what got me started on this thing. And Jerry, it literally changed my life when I read the damn thing and realized that the UFO subject was not merely a passing fancy. It was real, and I determined after a long time that it was undoubtedly the most major important issue in the history of the human race.
Now, when you discovered the secret document, and many people have heard this story, but a lot of people come to into these radio shows and don't hear all the details. So if I ask some redundant questions, I hope you'll forgive me.
Oh, not a problem. No.
That had just, knocked your socks off, as we say in Oklahoma, where I'm from, when you saw this thing.
It was a military study. It was initiated in 1963, before I ever got there. It was initiated after an event in February of 1961, where a large number of unidentified objects flew over Central Europe. They flew out of the Soviet sector over the Warsaw Pact area, over Central Europe, over NATO territory. And all the alarms went off. The Russians had gone on full alert. The NATO forces went on full alert. In those days, no one really knew very much about these objects. For a time, the NATO people thought these objects might belong to the Soviets. We learned later that for a time, the Soviets thought they might belong to NATO or to the Americans or British, whatever. We were to find out later that, of course, these objects did not belong to anyone, and that they were not from here. So they initiated the study in 61 after this event. It took 3 years. I arrived in 63. The document was published in 64. And as I told you, it literally changed my life because I realized for the first time that this was not only a big story, it was the greatest story in human history.
Well, incredible, and certainly is. After all these decades, what is your opinion about it? Do you think it's all the same group of extraterrestrials or what?
Well, my conclusions over the years, I've been really studying it now for 40 years, trying to come to terms with what's really been going on. My conclusions are very similar to what was published in the NATO study in 1964.
So it didn't change much.
Well, it developed. I developed a much deeper understanding of the meaning of the phenomenon. We knew in 64 that we're dealing with several different groups, not just merely one group, that there were at least four, maybe as many as a dozen different groups involved coming here from different places. And I've concluded that that's not only true, but we learned in the military, Jerry, before I retired in 76, that we're not merely dealing with interstellar or interplanetary, we're dealing with multidimensional intelligences. And the biggest story, I think, one of the biggest stories in my view, is that these guys have been coming and going and been interested in us for thousands of years. And the implications in one of the most sensitive areas that really is why the lid is still being kept on this is that there's some strong indications that these intelligences have had a hand in the establishment of all of the major religions on this planet. And that, as you can understand, is dynamite.
Basically, when we talk about this, and you've laid this case out over the years, the thing that always struck me about it, originally, like you said, the military wasn't all that far off from what you've decided after four decades of studying. How did they get this information?
Well, the three-year study was sharply focused. It was a military study. And the subtitle of the document, which was called An Assessment, the subtitle was An Evaluation of a Possible Military Threat to Allied Forces in Europe. That was the focus, and it was direct. As I said, they included there were several different groups involved. They concluded that they were interplanetary or interstellar. They concluded that there apparently was not a threat involved because the repeated demonstration of advanced technology, Jerry, indicated that if these guys were malevolent or hostile, they would have cleaned our clock a long time ago, yeah. So the conclusion was that they're here, they've been here a long time, they are deeply involved and interested in the human race and our development and our evolution, but they're not a threat, apparently. But over the years, my focus is, you know, what is the overall meaning and purpose of the program? Why are they so interested in us? And why have they been interested in us for so long?
And what kind of conclusions have you come up with?
Well, I've reached a couple of conclusions. One, I must tell you, is very similar to Zechariah Sitchin's conclusion. I've known Zechariah for many years. I admire his work. I've always admired everything the old man has written is outstanding. I've concluded that the evidence, Jerry, is pretty definite. I would say overwhelming. That some of these advanced intelligences, at least one group, had a hand in the human race being here. That we were probably genetically manipulated and genetically created from a lower order a long, long time ago. And I support Zechariah's research and his conclusion. That's probably the case. And as I said, not only have they had a hand in the race being here, but they've established over the centuries every major religion on the planet.
In this overall concept about this, Robert Dean, the thing that I've wondered about, the religions are all very similar in many ways anyway, but are they conscious of what dynamite it would be if, for instance, the Disclosure Project actually came about?
Well, I've always concluded that if they wanted the Disclosure Project to come out, they, and I refer to the guys upstairs there, they could have orchestrated this a long time ago. There are two reasons why the lid is still being kept down. One is that our government is scared to death of the truth. And the other reason is, and I think you referred to it, is that they, the visitors, whatever you wish to call them, I hate the word alien, that doesn't even apply. I think they're sensitive to the overall human situation here, where they're not about to upend us sociologically, psychologically, theologically. I think they are sensitive to the human condition and the fact that probably a massive display, a massive disclosure, would be tremendously unsettling to the planet.
when we, you know, you said you don't want to use the word alien, which I understand. What how would you refer to them?
Well, I refer to them in some of my presentations as part of our extended family because I think we're related to them. As a matter of fact, one of the conclusions that the SHAPE research program concluded in 64, that there's one group that looks exactly like we do. And you can't tell the damn difference. If they were to put on a suit and tie and sit next to you in a restaurant or a plane, you wouldn't know the difference. And that's always bothered the admirals and the generals. But one of the groups looks so much like us to be almost identical. And I think those are the ones that genetically engineered us.
And the other groups, what do they look like?
Well, they, interestingly enough, almost everyone that I have had exposure to and have done research on are humanoid in the sense that they stand upright, they have two arms, two legs, two eyes, and they generally look human in the overall physical condition. But if you were to pass one of them on the street, there are some of them that are pretty far out. You know, their eyes are large. Some of them have eyes with reptilian pupils. Some of them have skin that is not normal. I mean,
so the basis of some of this, actually, you hear the descriptions of this or that, the Retrievans or whatever, there's some basis in those facts that at least there's some similarity.
There are the overall humanoid form.
And the human race being it is, we expand on it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But there are some that would scare the hell out of you if you ran into them in the middle of the night on the street, I'm sure. And that's one reason why they're sensitive, I think, to our condition, and they don't want to upset us too damn much.
When you talk about other dimensions and other, maybe we need to get into that a little bit. It's fairly easy for a guy or a girl listening to say, well, yeah, they're from another interstellar zone somewhere, and they've somehow been able to master time and space to get here. But expand on why you say the other part of it.
Well, science is really, at this moment, traditional science is undergoing a revolution. With quantum physics being the way it is, and some of the newer discoveries about the speed of light, one thing or another, there have been brilliant theoretical physicists who've recently concluded that there probably are as many as 10 or 12 separate dimensions in time-space. And, you know, that's a factor, that's a theory that I haven't very much background in. I haven't studied physics to that degree to understand exactly what Michio Kaku is talking about when he describes 10 or 12 different dimensions. Apparently there are other levels of reality in time and space that we weren't even aware of.
And so when you hear people talking about parallel universes, et cetera, they may not be that far off.
Well, apparently it's pretty damn right on, you see.
Right.
I've read Michio Kaku's work, and the man's brilliant. He's a teacher at New York University, and he is one of the top theoretical quantum physicists on the planet, and he covers that pretty thoroughly. And I pretty well concluded that these way out on the edge quantum physicists, these theorists, are pretty correct. That there probably are very unlimited dimensions in time and space.
So really, it's almost, I hate to use an old term, beyond human ken, but it's very hard for us to really even grasp what the whole total picture probably is.
Well, if you were to try to give it a comparison, I think the human race scientifically, sociologically, psychologically, probably, and theologically are in the third or fourth grade. And, you know, we're dealing with guys from out there that are not only in graduate school, but are teaching the whole program, you see, and here humanity is in the second or third grade. We got a long way to go.
Well, your conclusion, you mentioned one conclusion. You may have another one as well. You said you got two conclusions, not only the fact that they, you know, there's four, at least four, maybe many more. What else did you decide?
Jerry, I think the final conclusion that really I focused on most of my years doing my presentations and my study is that this is a spiritual matter. It's a spiritual issue. It isn't about them necessarily. It's about us. And it isn't about us necessarily on a limit of a physical plane. Yeah, I think it has to do with spirituality, the human being, what he is, where he came from, where he's going. And I've learned over the years that I don't tend to belong to organized and structured religions, but I have become over the years as I've studied this, I think a lot more spiritual in my focus. And I look at on right now that the human being basically is an infinite, immortal, spiritual being. And he just happens to be living in a human body for a short period of time.
You know, that's one of the interesting things about, you said it changed your life, and I've been doing these programs almost as long as you've been doing your stuff. I've been on radio since the late 50s, and the thing I've noticed is that one thing in common about all of these contacts or whatever information they find when people really get ready to accept this, they do have kind of a life-altering exchange. They become more spiritual.
Oh, there's no question about it. I'm a great admirer of Ed Mitchell, for example. I've known him for some years. I've talked to him a few times. And I find that Ed, on his trip to the moon and back, he said that was a life-changing experience, and he says that in terms of spirituality, it opened him up to things in his life were never, ever the same. Well, my research into this field has just about done the same thing to me.
We're talking about Robert Dean. We're going to let you go in a minute. I know that you have a few other things you want to do here and tie up for hours talking about this, but we won't. We'll give you a break.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
You hear all these different species, and then you talk about the craft. There were conventional saucers, I guess, at first. The triangles are around now. What do you think about all that?
Well, there's obviously a lot of changes going on in U.S. military technology. There's a strong indication that a lot of the stuff we see in the skies at night and now during the day maybe American technology. There's some strong indications of that. I've had some old friends in the military who've told me that, technically speaking, that we are 30 to 50 years ahead of what most people have any idea of. So a lot of what we're seeing out there is probably our own stuff. But there's still no doubt for a moment that many of the most incredible, fantastic things we see are from the guys from elsewhere.
So the guys from elsewhere, we're actually a grand experiment for them, or is it that?
Well, would you look upon a child of your own as an experiment?
You got a good point there.
You know, I think, honestly, that they look upon us as adolescents, children, perhaps, of a hopeful race, a race that might have a future if it behaves itself and doesn't blow itself up. I think they do have a benevolent, sometimes even a loving approach to us.
Has there been any intervention that you can tell? Because when you have a child and starts doing the wrong thing.
You mean, have we been spanked?
Yes.
Well, We have been very, very clearly guided in a few directions. I mean, one case I'll give you, I could talk for a couple of hours on it, but there's one case in particular where a group of American fighter planes were vectored in on an unknown at one time. And three or four of our fighters, hotshot kids, vectored in on this object, and as they got close to it, they spotted it, and they armed their gun cameras. And at the same time, which armed the guns. At that particular moment, all the electronics in the cockpit went zip. I mean, just literally shut down. And here these kids are sitting in these high-flying super jets, which I might tell you have the glide capability of an anvil.
And
if you turn the engine off, you're in deep doo-doo, as they used to say. And here these kids are sitting in these hotshot planes. They turn on arm their gun cameras so they could take pictures, and arm the guns so that they could, you know, defend themselves. Well, all of their electronics went down. And apparently the object recognized that they were arming their guns directed something at them that turned off all of the electronics. And these jets with these kids in there, well, you know, we're really getting uptight at this moment, start going down. And as they broke off and started down, within about 10 or 15 seconds, as they pulled away and were ready to crash, all of their electronics came back on. So the pilots were able to get control of the jets and regain, you know, some speed and some altitude. And by that time, the object had disappeared, and most of the fighter pilots at that time were in no mood to try to follow it any further, you know.
I can understand.
They were heading back to base to find out what the hell had happened. So there are incidents like that time and time and time again where they have, I think, said to us, no, no, don't do that.
You know, your association with people in the military, and still even today you're in contact with them, it seems to me from a casual observer of the military seems to be handling these interceptions of ETs or unknown craft a lot differently than they used to.
Well, I'll tell you one story. Back about 1952, a shoot-to-kill order was issued by the Air Force. It was rescinded within 30 days because several of our jets really took some hostile action against these objects. And because of that, we lost some planes and crews. And that shoot-to-kill order was rescinded by the Air Force, and it's never been issued again. So I think some of our top leaders, very early on, back in the 50s, learned, you know, they do not appear to be malevolent and hostile to us. So we damn well better be careful in trying to be malevolent and hostile to them, because it isn't going to pay off.
Robert Dean, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. You've been studying all of this. What do you see anything happening in the future? Is it more of the same, or is there going to be a major event, or do you have any clue?
Well, Jerry, first of all, I want to thank you for the moments, the time you've given me here. I want to close with one or two points. When I first came out of the closet years ago,
yeah, I understand what you're talking about. Yeah,
on the subject.
We got you, yes.
Okay. The purpose I had back in those days was to spread what information I had learned with as many people as I could, because I, at that time, believed that this knowledge and the awareness and the reality of all this would bring about, among human beings, an expansion of consciousness, which I think is long overdue and certainly necessary if we're to survive. The other thing that I've determined over the years is that we're learning and growing at a very fast pace. The whole world is evolving tremendously fast. And I think that in the next few years, you and your listeners are probably going to see some absolutely mind-boggling things taking place. And I would say to the people, you know, don't get uptight about it. Be strong and keep your mind open and be prepared for a new world. We're going to be facing that, and we're going to be living in it very, very soon.
Well, are you pretty optimistic about the results of that? I imagine you would be.
Well, I've gone hot and cold over the years. I've been cynical and I've been pessimistic as hell. But overall, I think I've matured some as I've gotten older. And yeah, I'm optimistic, Jerry. I really am. I think there's a future for the human race, and I do believe that future is in space.
Robert Dean, that's a good way to close it. Thank you very much.
Well, Jerry, I thank you. Good luck to you.
Prince Anthony was the handsomest man in the entire kingdom.
Man, am I handsome.
His fondest wish was to find a beautiful bride.
Of course, she doesn't have to be as stunning as me.
But Prince Anthony couldn't find one. Why? Well, because he never left the palace.
Being this pretty isn't easy.
He spent all day lifting weights and getting his back waxed. And trimming and grooming and tweezing and twerking.
Perfecting perfection.
Meanwhile, his less good-looking but far more charming brother Benji found a bride. So did his rather unattractive cousins and even his flat-out butt-ugly Uncle Stanley.
I don't understand it. I am way better looking looking at any of them.
Unfortunately, none of the women in the kingdom knew this because none of them had ever seen him.
Not if they ever did.
But they didn't. So Prince Anthony spent his entire life all alone until he was old and toothless, bald and fat, saggy and rather flabby.
At least my back isn't very hairy.
You may have the best product or service in the world, but if nobody knows about it, you just have the best product or service in the world. It's called advertising, and it works. Your competitors know this. Why don't you? This message brought to you by this station, Adweek Magazine, the Radio Advertising Bureau, and the famous Radio Ranch.
Dennis Balthai is on the line from Roswell, New Mexico. And Dennis, the weather's getting warmer out there all the time.
It certainly is. It's not awful. I like summer, so it's on the way.
Now, you just got back from Aztec, a big conference, and we have Roswell coming up in July. And I want to talk to you about both of those conferences.
I just got back from Aztec Monday night, and two nights ago, and 3 weeks ago, I was out in Sedona, Arizona, so I've been in two of my favorite places in the Southwest, I think, Sedona, Arizona, and Aztec, New Mexico.
Yeah, you're definitely definitely right about that. Both places are very, very pretty.
They really are.
How did the conference go at Aztec this year? What was this, the fifth year or the...
Seventh.
Okay.
Annual symposium. I've been at five of them, participating in five as a speaker 3 years, and then master ceremonies 2 years.
Yeah, they had it at a different place this time.
Yeah, they had it at the middle school, which worked out real well. They have a big auditorium. They had a gigantic screen set up for the overheads and the PowerPoints that the speakers used and things like that. And all the speakers had tables set up on the other side of the room where people could buy products from them and visit and talk with them. So it worked out really well this year.
Now, you were the MC, and I don't know if you took your drum set with you or not.
No, I didn't. In fact, I found out Freddie Kimball plays guitar, and he asked me why I didn't bring my drums so we could jam a little bit.
Yeah, that would have been pretty nice. Tell us about Freddie Kimball.
Freddie Silva is from England. And I think he has about three different citizenships, including the United States, from the time. He did an excellent presentation on crop circles, mostly from England, and gave some really thought-provoking info.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about those crop circles, you get all kinds of reports, and they have one at one time that supposedly one was near Stonehenge there with
He mentioned that one.
Yeah, he did, huh?
He did. And he was also talking about Stonehenge and some of the cathedrals and how there may be a connection in the all of that. The only problem I had was he's a firm believer that they are probably made by aliens, and I'm not convinced of that yet, but his presentation was well done. He did a nice job. He came into Aztec Friday night extremely sick and doctored himself up for 2 days, and then did his presentation on Sunday morning, and did a really nice presentation.
You know, I'm kind of in the middle on those crop circles. I think many of them are not inspired by ETs, but some of them seem like they're ET art. What's he think they are?
Basically, because of the time involved, he said they now have some footage of some actually developing within 15 to 30 seconds, and they just appear. I have my own theory on them, which nobody has ever thought about or mentioned. And
well, I'd like to hear it.
The possibility of sitting at a computer anywhere in the world and putting a design, a computer, and shooting it to a satellite with microwave, and then reflecting it back down somewhere in that same hemisphere, which could be done anywhere in the northern or the southern hemisphere, depending where you're at, and the microwaves, I think, would probably take the moisture out of the crop and cause it to fall over and form it.
So you think it's some computer geeks?
I think it's a possibility. I don't know that anybody's ever researched it, but and that's not one of my research things. But I think it's a possibility that it could be done that way. There definitely have been some hoaxes, and that's been proven that they've been hoaxed using a board and rope and stuff like that. But some of these designs, Jerry, are so intricate to make them things, even by hand, at night in the dark, I don't see how it could be done.
Well, you got a good point there. Have there been many crop circles in New Mexico? First of all, I guess you got to find growing things.
I was going to say, we don't have farms. That's not true. We have a good farm.
No, I'm kidding.
I don't know of any in New Mexico. There may have been some, but I don't recall here.
Yeah, I've never had any reports of them either, I don't think. I don't remember them, at least.
Cattle mutilations we've had. We've had a lot of those.
Yes, and they're still going on.
Mm-hmm. But Paul Kimball was there, and he's a movie producer and does television documentaries, and he presented...
Yeah, I got Paul and Freddie confused there for a minute. I did the first of it. We'll get the Kimball name messed up there, but what about Paul?
He presented a film at the symposium in Aztec called Do You Believe in Magic? And it's an excellently done video, about an hour long, with Stanton Friedman and Carl Flock. And Bruce Maccabee is in it, and Greenwald, the young kid who's doing all the Freedom of Information requests. But it's probably one of the best documentaries in Stanton that I've seen in a long time. Carl tries to put down the Majestic 12, Carl Flock, and Stanton just keeps coming back with information after information on it. So I think it's going to air in Canada sometime in April, and hopefully it'll be picked up in the United States on one of the channels and also shown here.
Well, we'll keep our eyes open for that one. That was kind of a thing that you guys did at Aztec in person 3 years ago. You had Stanton and Carl Flock there.
Yeah. Carl was there one of the years that I was Master of Ceremonies, and also one of the years that I was doing a lecture. I understand Carl broke his leg and is also going to have some kind of surgery.
Now, Stanton didn't do that, did he?
I don't think so. He might have wanted to at times.
Well, we wish him good luck.
Yeah, we do. The thing I like about Carl Flock, he's consistently wrong, but he's consistent.
Yeah, right. Well, that being consistent is important, I tell you, in the broadcast business. And Stanton Friedman, am I correct? Is he going to be back at Roswell?
He will be, yes. This coming July, he'll be here.
Yeah, we're going to run down everybody in Roswell in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about Aztec.
One of the other ones that was there was Art Campbell, and Art has been doing a lot of work on the plains of San Augustine, which Stanton has tried to tie in with the Roswell incident on many occasions, indicating that possibly there were two craft that had a mid-air collision, one going down in the plains of San Augustine, and the other one coming in here to the Roswell area. But Art has picked up some artifacts from out at the site at San Augustine that are very, very strange. He's got what appears to be a shoe sole that is so small that it wouldn't even fit on an infant's foot. The width of it, just you couldn't get a baby's foot inside it. And he had that with him, and he also had something else that we don't know what it is, but it had a piece of gold wire, probably a tenth the size of a human hair, and also some flat copper wire. And it's almost a plastic-looking material, rubbery-type plastic-looking material, and he had that with him also. And I'm wondering if that may not be the computer circuit or something that melted down.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
He hasn't had them analyzed yet, to my knowledge, but it's extremely interesting information he presented. Now, I've been working the plains of San Augustine for many years, and the Barney Burnett portion of it and different people.
How far is that from Roswell, exactly?
It's over around Socorro, around the VLA, where the very large array of the satellite dishes are. Maybe 60 miles west of Roswell.
Well, are they going to continue to have the thing at Aztec?
As far as I know, yeah. They were talking about next year. They don't have any speakers lined up yet, but they definitely were talking about next year. And I'm hoping that I get to go as a speaker.
rather than the MC?
Either, yeah, but rather as a speaker, because I have one of my lectures that I haven't presented up there yet deals with the pyramids, and there were a lot of people interested in that when they found out that I was involved with the pyramids. And some of the speakers we had, it was very, I don't know, dissatisfied or upset with, I guess. One of them was Nancy Red Star.
Yeah, we talked about her.
She was brought in as a
last-minute replacement. She's a filmmaker up in Taos, right?
Yes. He did her presentation Sunday morning, and after I introduced her, I was sitting around watching, listening to her lecture, and she had a video about an hour long of American information. She did interviews with several Native Americans, medicine women and medicine men and things like that, and of pretty good historical value. And then she was interviewing an older gentleman, and he started talking about his involvement with the government and that he guarded the Roswell aliens in 1947 at Area 51 in Nevada, and he said he was guarding 24/7 for a year at Area 51.
Well, Area 51, was it even around then?
Bingo. And I'm getting to the point where these researchers that are putting out information that is totally bogus, I no longer am going to talk to them privately. I'm going to do it in public. And I confronted her. I challenged her. Afterwards, we had a question and answer session after each speaker. And when it came time for the questions and answers, I walked up to the microphone and I said, Nancy, I have been researching Roswell and Area 51 for the past 20 years. I have documentation to prove that Area 51 was set up by the CIA in 1955. So the information you're putting out here is totally bogus. This man could not have been at Area 51 in 1947 guarding the bodies, since the bodies were shipped to Wright Patterson on an airplane piloted by Pappy Henderson. And she exploded. She said, well, you need to talk to him. You don't need to talk to me. I said, no, it's your video. You're on it doing the interview. And before you go public with something like that, you need to check on your information. Well, we were supposed to have a panel discussion after all the lectures were through Sunday afternoon, and she caught me out at my table where I was selling tapes and jumped my case. And I told her, I said, look, get off of it right now. Because I said, I will no longer stand for people doing what you did. I said, there's 100 people in there that believe what you said. And I said, I can, by validation and by credibility and by documentation, can prove you're wrong, and you should not be doing that. Well, she wanted me taken off the panel. So she went to the committee and said, I don't want him on the panel. And they told her that I was a good researcher, I was a master of ceremonies, I would be on the panel. She did not show up.
Well, a little action there at the...
I did, and I don't care to do it, but I've reached a point, Jerry, where I'm publicly going to go after these people. I've done it on my editorials with James Bond Johnson, who took the pictures in General Ramey's office, and now I've elaborated his story. I did it with Phil Klass when he questioned my credibility. I spent too much time and money and effort to try to get the truth out for somebody to come to one of these symposiums and put out these, almost call them lies, misinformation about this stuff. I'm just not going to put up with it anymore. If I get thrown out of the ufology community, fine, so be it. But I'll go down knowing that I did the best I could with the truth.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons we always like to have you on. After all, your website is called Truth Seekers.
I just can't imagine, you know, sitting there. I like to fell out of my chair when this guy started talking. He said, and I mean, he was serious as a heart attack. I guarded two Roswell live aliens at Area 51 in 1947. And she asked him, well, how did you sleep or how did you eat? And he said, they brought me my meals at the place where I was sitting guard, on standing on guard. Which is just totally bogus.
Was Nellis even in existence then?
No. Area 51 came about in 55 because the CIA needed a place to test the U-2. Edwards wasn't secretive enough in California, so they looked at 12 locations in the southwest, found Groom Lake, and decided that would be where they would put the the airstrip to test the U-2 and started putting buildings up. Had a fake contractor, or CLR was the name of the company, the fake contractor that built them. I'm not sure that the Seabees didn't build it, because I interviewed a guy up in Aztec and talked to him who said he was part of building the base. And they did it in 1954, he said.
Really?
He came out of that same lecture and asked me what I thought of it. I said, well, it's totally bogus. He said, well, I know for a fact because I helped build part of it in 1954.
Now, that is one of the problems we have, even doing our UFO shows. You get some of these people on, and you're right, they should be challenged.
I'm going to do it from now on. In fact, I'm seriously thinking of my next editorial being about that, writing about it and mentioning names, and I'm not going to pull any punches. If they want to accuse me of slander or whatever they want, get after it, because I got the documentation back.
Yeah, I started saying, I know the truth is the absolute defense.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it.
Anything else about Aztec before we get over to Roswell here?
Not other than that it's a good symposium every year. Scott Ramsey was there, and he has never done a lecture. He's from North Carolina, has been involved.
Yeah, we've talked about him before, and he's a pretty good investigator, isn't he?
He is. He did his first lecture ever at Aztec, and he did it on Aztec, and he showed a lot of documentation he obtained from the archives at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. He's been there many, many times. He's got 1,300 documents and has a good relationship with the archive people there and has been able to get a lot of information. And now has uncovered several radar locations in New Mexico which could have had an involvement in both the Aztec and the Roswell crash because of microwaves. The Air Force denied these places existed, and he and a few other guys have located them, got pictures of them from the ground and from the air. Went back to the Air Force, and the Air Force finally has admitted, yes, they did have them. So there was one not too far from Aztec. There was one at Moriarty, which is between Albuquerque and Klein's Corner.
Right, we know where that is.
And there was another portable one near Corona, which would involve the Roswell craft. That one was temporary. The other two were permanent structures. So this is something we probably ought to look at, too, that possibly microwaves could have had something to do. Because the aliens at Aztec supposedly were burned. The craft was pretty much intact when it came down, but some of the aliens and some of the beings inside apparently were burned, which could have been a microwave problem.
And we've thought about that and talked about that over the years. That was a different kind of radar they use now,
it
I guess.
It certainly was. It was hot, extremely hot. So, it could have affected guidance systems or propulsion, or could have done a lot of things. And the range of it could have been sufficient enough to get in contact with these things.
You didn't run across anybody that knew any more about Dulce, did you?
No. I was asked about...
I mean, that's close.
During the panel discussion, I was asked about Dulce and was hoping I'd get somebody to come forward with some information, but nobody did. But we'll keep after that.
We're talking with Dennis Balthizer. This is the UFO Files. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Dennis is on the line from Roswell, New Mexico. And every 4th of July weekend, they have an incredible... what would you call it? A celebration? The whole city gets behind everything.
Yes, the UFO anniversary of the Roswell incident every July. Well, the incident happened July 4th, we believe, so it's in that area always, the first week of July. This year it's the 1st through the 4th.
Now, you were telling me the speakers are actually going to be, most of them will be someplace else besides the museum, is that right?
No, I found out that the only one that will not be at the museum is Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. He will be at the Civic Center. I don't have dates on him yet, but I know sometime between July 1st and July 4th. And most people that come for this usually come for the Holy Man anyway.
Yes, they do. Now, Edgar Mitchell, didn't he go up to Aztec one time?
He was there, about 3 years ago, I believe it was.
Yeah. He's the fellow that went to the moon and had a life-changing experience.
In fact, man on the moon, yeah.
Yeah, we were just talking to Robert Dean a little earlier in the show, He was talking about Mitchell and how much of a life-changing experience he really had.
Yeah. How's Dean doing? I haven't heard from him in a long time.
He's doing all right. He's not getting around too much. He's kind of locked there in Phoenix. He did, of course, come to Laughlin for the UFO conference there, first time to see some old friends.
But
he seems to be hanging in there.
Edgar has a lot of information. He's a brilliant, brilliant gentleman. I met him up in Aztec and got to talk to him one-on-one. Like you said, he did have a life-changing experience with his trip to the moon and back. In fact, I asked him what it was like to stand on the moon and look back at the Earth, and he said, "I don't know." And I said, "What do you mean you don't know?" He said, "Dennis," he said, "we really didn't have time. Our schedule was such that," he said, "I really didn't have time to look and do anything like that until on the way back." And he said, "Then when I was in the spacecraft coming back," he said, "it changed my life." So he was quite an interesting gentleman, so we're looking forward to seeing him again.
Now, Stanton Friedman, he'll be there at the museum itself.
Yes, Stanton and Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, and both Don and Tom have been involved with the sci-fi dig up at the crash site, and Don has been a long-time researcher at Roswell. Worked with Kevin Randall years ago. The three of them will be doing their presentations at the museum, and then I believe Saturday night there will be a panel discussion with Don and Tom and Stanton, and I'm going to try to talk to the museum manager and see if I might be able to moderate that. I'm hoping I can possibly moderate.
That would be great.
I'd like to do that since I know all of them anyway.
Yeah, that would be a very good little event.
I think you can probably go online at www.roswellufo.us, and the International UFO Museum is www.iufomrc.org. And I think either one of them websites would probably give information about the times of the speakers, the dates, and things like that. What they're planning is to have pretty much Main Street focused on the whole event. The north end will be the Civic Center, the south end will be the museum. In between, at the park and things like that, there'll be vendors and music and things like that.
Right, I mean, Merle Haggard, I guess, is still going to be back.
Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson are supposed to be out at the fairgrounds one night doing the concert, so that's going to be a big draw for people to come to town. And I wouldn't even guess how many will come. I would guess it could be anywhere from 20 to 40,000 people.
Well, it's, they had a fairly good crowd last year.
They did, and we have every year. Of course, 97 was the 50th anniversary, and that was the biggest one, but They have a good crowd every year, and it's being run well this year. The museum is handling it and doing a good job on preparing everything for it.
How are things going at the museum?
As far as I know, I'm not overly involved anymore, but they still get 200,000 people a year coming through there, which is a big number.
One of the things I like about that place is everybody there is friendly, and they want to make sure that that you're helped out, and they have that research center there, and people are welcome to do anything they want to there.
They have an excellent library. They probably have a library second to none now, right adjacent to where you come in the museum, and they have also have a Hall of Fame where they have the three founders, Glenn Dennis, Walter Haut, and Max Littell, photographs, plus some of us researchers that have been involved with the Roswell incident have pictures in there and information. And then they have the timeline for the Roswell incident, which you walk through and explains pretty much everything we know about the Roswell incident. Have an actual crash test dummy that the Air Force used for an excuse in 1997. And then they have some articles and pictures of crop circles and other ufology-related information.
Now, you know, about the Roswell crash itself, anything new in the last year? I know we talked a little bit about that picture General Ramey was holding, you know, where he was holding the memo up.
That's, to me, one of the big things. That may be the smoking gun, and we're still working on that. David Rudiak's doing a lot of good work on that, and we're pretty much in agreement that it does say victims of the wreck on that piece of paper he's holding. And weather balloons and mogul balloons did not have victims.
Not usually.
The other thing, of course, is the sci-fi dig where they got 64 bags of material. Those are being analyzed currently. Have not got results back yet from them. And they also want to go back and do some more digging, get some more samples, and also investigate the gouge that has been talked about. We believe there is a gouge there that's been filled in with dirt over the years. But they took a backhoe last time we were up there, and looks like there's a gouge about 2 or 3 feet below the surface. So we want to see if the archaeologists can pull out something from that, perhaps.
Hey, you know, you and I talked about the crash of the Aztec. It looked like it came in at an angle, too, and dug up the earth.
It had to, and the way it came in, it pretty much was intact. From what I understand from guys that have researched it, it wasn't damaged too much. There was two interesting things up there that have been discovered. One is a road, a dirt road that has been made that nobody knows why, which could have been to bring equipment in. And the other thing is a small concrete slab that was poured that they thought might be a well cap. Talking to the gas companies, they said, no, it's not a well cap. They actually ran a core sample down and took a concrete core out. They're having that analyzed, and right now it looks like the cement does relate to about 1940, 1945. So it could be that they brought in, they made a concrete slab to put an outrigger on a crane or something, because the craft was described as being about 99 feet in diameter, which is big.
Yeah, usually they're about 35 feet.
Yeah, so to handle it, they would have had some kind of a device, a crane or some type that could handle the load, and it may not have had any weight, but the size of it at least.
You know, you talked about the pyramids a little earlier. That's always really an interesting subject for everyone. Have you ever noticed? Every time you get around, I'm sure you have. When you get to the pyramids, all of a sudden their ears pick up.
You know, I fell upon it by accident. I've been interested in them for years, as I have been the Shroud of Turin and Noah's Ark and different things, you know, that just caught my curiosity. And to get involved like I have with this research group now is just fascinating for me, and if I keep getting disgusted with UFO speakers, I may have to dedicate more time to that.
I understand, and you know, let's talk a little bit about that group. They're actually still hard at it investigating the pyramids, and you guys have come up with a conclusion. They were probably several thousand years older than what we think they are.
Yeah, I think that's a given, Jerry. If you look at the Sphinx has deterioration on it caused by water, and there hasn't been water in that part of the world for a good 10 or 15,000 years, and that predates the Egyptian civilization. And like I told you before, there's a gentleman, Stephen Mueller, who has done a lot of research. In fact, he's going back over in November with some more guys to do some more research in Egypt, and he says that there was a civilization known as Khemesians who lived in North Africa, black civilization predominantly controlled by the female gender.
Well, and you mentioned the Sphinx does look like a black woman.
I think the face does resemble it, and I'm not sure if the face is original or if it's been altered over the years, because it's totally out of proportion with the body of the lion that the Sphinx is. The back part, pretty much, the back part of the head pretty much is in proportion, but the front part, to me, is totally out of proportion with the rest of it. And there's some information that we think inside the left paw. The Egyptians will not let anybody go in there. We found that there's tunnels underneath the pyramids and the Sphinx, so we have a whole lot of work to do, but the toughest part is going to be trying to convince the Egyptians that they're not Egyptian. That's going to be a hard sell, because the tourists...
They make a lot of money for them being Egyptians.
They do.
But I think they would... I think they're misreading that, as I mentioned earlier.
I mean, if you find out that they're not Egyptian... I know that. I'm convinced that there's 80-some pyramids in Egypt, and I believe most of them are Egyptian. But if you really look at them, they're poor replicas of the three pyramids of Giza. So there was different technology used for the three pyramids of Giza than there were for any other pyramids in the world. And the engineering involved, the technology, just doesn't match up with anything then or now.
Well, folks listening, you need to go over to Dennis's website. He writes pretty good editorials, and it sounds like he's got another one perking along here. Why don't you give that website address again for everybody?
Okay, www.truthseeker@Roswell, that's all one word, .com. Truthseeker@Roswell.
Okay, it's singular, Truthseeker.
Truthseeker@Roswell, the
okay.
word at.
It's all together.
Right.
And, you know, you've got a good website. A lot of people go visit it. We have a link to it. We have a link to those websites you mentioned about the museum as well on our website at jerrypippin.com.
And yeah, I'm really fortunate with the webmaster I have. She's a genius. She takes my little words and does magic things with them on that website, really.
Well, gee, I thought you did all that in the middle of the night.
No. I'm lucky to be able to type a few words at a time.
Yeah. So, for the rest of this year, what are you going to be working on, basically? I know you had an interesting editorial last month.
Yeah, that got published in the New MUFON Journal, and they've asked to use two more of mine, and they've had to use some in the past, so I'm excited that the MUFON Journal is starting to pick up my editorials, and that's ongoing. I try to get a new one out about every other month, and, of course, the pyramids and whatever happens with Roswell this year, I'll be involved with that, and then hopefully get some more information on the underground bases and Area 51 and things like that, so keep plugging away at it.
The underground bases, they're kind of an interesting subject simply because it seems to me there's more than one category. There may be some that involve extraterrestrials, and then there may be some involved in a secret government type project, and et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
Yeah, and that is my best-selling video. I noticed again up at Aztec, my wife was selling my videos while I was doing the emceeing and stuff, and she said that the underground bases are the best-selling video that I have, and I think it's because people are pretty much interested in the underground bases and know very little about it. I got into it because of my engineering background. It's a natural for me because I wanted to know what kind of equipment they were using and how they were doing it. So I guess my most popular lectures are underground bases and Area 51.
Area 51 still shrouded in mystery, no doubt about it.
Yeah. It's not gone away. It's not been moved. It's still there, running, up and running. And just recently, President Bush put out a proclamation declaring it off limits to everybody.
Well, they've been doing that every year, every president.
It started with Clinton about 1995 when they had the lawsuit from the two women whose husbands had been exposed to toxic waste radiation.
Well, they put a new water tower up, you said.
They did.
So maybe it's toxic waste everywhere.
Well, I'm guessing that the water is probably contaminated in the area. And I know that they do check ranchers and cattle in the vicinity every so often for radio, to see if there's any radiation leaking out of the base and things like that. But, of course, they don't have to comply with the environmental laws that everybody else does. That's what the proclamation of the president says. You know, they don't have to comply with EPA requirements, which
yeah,
is not fair to anybody.
And it's not fair. I think there's a lot of Air Force jets are exempt, too.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, you know, it's not really. Hey, Dennis, I appreciate you always bringing us up to date. We'll be talking to you again soon, and we'll see you in Roswell.
Look forward to it, Jerry.
Dennis Balthizer, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. Our time is up. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Watch out for those flying saucers and all. Oh, yes. Cheers.